Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 1st of May. I did want to thank Tom Martin Erickson for helping produce last hour's program. It was very nice of him to give us some Utah Phillips music. And he, of course, is the host of Simply Folk, a terrific show heard here on Wisconsin Public Radio. One more piece of business. Our spring pledge drive starts on Thursday, but you could pledge online right now, which would help shorten this drive. Our goal is $275,000, and we already have listeners who've contributed over $16,000. And you can join them by pledging online at WPR.org, and you could do that right now, and that would shorten this drive. Oh, it's $18,000. We had $2,000 today, huh? What a deal! We're at $18,000. Thank you very much. That's great. All right, we're going to continue. I'm still somewhat involved in last hour's show, and we're moving on now to something different. We're going to talk about money in politics now. I don't know if you were knocked out by how much money it has been raised in by the Democrats and also by the Republicans. Our guest has an interesting piece. Matt Bai is with us the first part of this hour. In the New York Times Sunday Magazine this past Sunday, the Way We Live Now section, the post-money era is what it's titled. Why $50 million in campaign contributions isn't what it used to be. Matt is a contributing writer for the magazine. His book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics will be published in August. A little bit later this hour, we will be speaking with the CEO and co-founder of Pajamas Media. They provide analysis and commentary of issues of the day through their network of over 90 worldwide bloggers and through original stories and podcasts and videos. So we go to Matt first, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Hello, Matt. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Nice to be here.
So those Democrats have some money, huh?
They're raising some bucks, aren't they?
Big bucks. And now all of a sudden they're out there advertising how much money they've raised. It used to be we don't have as much money. We're not as rich as the Republicans.
Right. They're all a bunch of rich people. Well, the Internet helped change. That's not an entirely hypocritical or bad development for Democrats. I mean, they shattered all the records. Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama alone, each raising over $25 million in the first quarter. That's almost three times what Al Gore did in the previous high quarter of the same at the same point in the cycle back in 1999. And also, you know, we forget John Edwards, but he also well-eclipsed
right.
what Gore had done. He's up somewhere over $14 million. And a lot of that is, there's a lot of enthusiasm, obviously, over the war, over the president. But a lot of that is the advent of the Internet and a lot of ordinary people sitting in, which as we like to call them, sitting at home and actually, clicking a button because it's an easy way to give. And Obama in particular, we see this phenomenon, 50,000 online donors. That's mm-hmm. that actually brings political money a little closer to what the Supreme Court always tells us it is, which is an expression of free speech. So in that sense, it's not all bad.
Yeah. What's the story with the Democrats raising so much money? You did, and I'd like you to talk a little bit more about this. You say in the article that there are now about as many affluent Democrats as there are Republicans.
Yeah, this is a Pew poll, the Pew Center, which is a very good polling outfit. And they their recent poll, and it's just a few weeks ago, which found that basically now affluence, which they defined it being, I think over 80,000 or so per household. Don't quote me on it, but that's some people who are around that figure for a household would tell you they don't feel especially affluent. But if you want to define sort of wealth that way, there are in that top bracket now as many Democratic donors as there are Republican, or as many self-identified Democrats. I'm sorry, as there are self-identified Republicans. That's going to shift. I don't know if that's a permanent change. It has a lot to do with voters who don't play for one team or the other, so to speak, but who are really probably outraged at what's happening in the White House and in Iraq and are voicing that displeasure by identifying more with Democrats. But it's probably also true, anybody who spent any time in Cambridge or Berkeley or Aspen or Los Angeles or Manhattan lately can probably tell you that there are probably a larger segment of truly wealthy Democrats than there used to be.
What are they doing for a living, Matt?
All sorts of things.
Yeah.
They're they're lawyers and doctors, they're professionals, they're academics, they're there is not the same we don't live in the same sort of corporate management culture that dominated 25 or 30 years ago, and so a lot of the people who make up top income brackets, they're in software, they're in service industries, they're in industries that are not traditionally sort of manufacturing, corporate, or you know, what we think of as culturally conservative industries. So that's, and that's one reason that you are seeing an increase. I don't know that that's the main reason you're seeing an increase in what Democrats are doing relative to Republicans. I think the internet's a big piece of it, and I think the biggest piece of it, as I say, is just the moment. I don't know that you'll see this. I don't think this represents any kind of structural shift. I think it represents a tremendous outpouring of frustration with the situation in the country today.
So what do you think? Federal matching funds, goodbye? Everybody's just going to raise as much as they possibly can now?
Yeah, I think so. Well, we've already seen that in the primary process. That's a done deal. That ship, that proverbial ship has sailed. You know, that happened last time around, and this time there's no candidate who can afford to take matching funds in the primary process. Frankly, you wouldn't be considered a serious candidate if you had to do that, which is a real problem for the integrity of the system. The question is whether we will see in the general election the two candidates turn down whatever it is, the $75 million that you get from public funds in an effort to raise more. Hillary Clinton, for one, is already going around asking people for donations and getting a lot of them donations for the general election, which indicates that she very much would intend as a nominee not to take matching funds. That probably means the other candidates are in the same boat. They probably think they can do better financially and spend more money if they don't take matching funds. And so that will be an entirely new thing this cycle, but I would not be at all surprised if candidates of both parties essentially opted out, and that would basically render our entire campaign finance system meaningless.
Yeah, it sure would. Don't you, on some level, you would think, Matt, that these guys and gals would find it rather tedious to go to all these fundraisers. It's day after day, city after city, flying all over the place when, you know, they could be studying history or visiting parts of the world where they haven't been before to get a better understanding of how they might lead.
I'm going to tell you, Kathleen, they do. I mean, we should not. It's an excellent question, and we shouldn't caricature them as people who just love to go out. You know, these people get into politics because they love to raise money. They hate it. Hate it, and the people, half the people who give the fundraisers hate it, and the lobbyists who bundle hate it, and nobody likes the system, except for, you know, a couple people who just love to be near the near powerful candidates and get them in their home and bring a lot of their friends. Look, I have John Edwards in my home or whatever. But nobody loves the system. Look, there's two things that drive them to do this, I would say, in a very broad generalization. One is that we basically have a national primary system. We've so front-loaded the primaries at this point. We, the parties, have so front-loaded the primaries, and particularly the Democrats, that you really have to have so much money. My guess is that you need at least $50 million to be competitive in the primary season, and then you want to add to that. I mean, you've got, you know, states upon – I mean, very early in the process now, you'll have states like California and Florida. I mean, you're really going to have a tremendous amount of money you need to raise. And the second piece of it is that you want people like me, and I say that broadly speaking because I don't do a lot of this kind of stuff, but you want – you know, daily reporters, people covering politics every day, to take you seriously and to exalt your chances. And the only thing that the sort of pundit class and the media has to talk about for a large portion of the campaign is the money. I mean, let's face it, voters in Iowa aren't going to tune in and make a decision in their caucus within 2 to 3 weeks of the actual election, which isn't the actual caucus, which isn't taking place till the end of January of next year. From now right up until that period, what a lot of people are going to be looking at is polls and money, and at this point, particularly money. And so the candidates are very eager to get out and forge that impression. I mean, it was a big blow for Hillary Clinton to not substantially outraise Barack Obama in any way, and she actually was outraised for the primary because her entire argument is that she's the institutional candidate and she's got way more resources than everybody else. Well, that's clearly not true anymore. So this is what drives the process, and I really believe the candidates would welcome, and a lot of people raising the money would welcome, a change in the system that created less demand for all of this.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't it make you feel a little bit squeamish that we're tying resources with legitimacy?
Yes, it does. It makes me very squeamish, and there's no other way to put it. I can't wave a wand and change it. I try not to contribute to it. But yeah, the honest answer is yes. I think it's very problematic for the same reason that I don't like suggestions that we hold debates only for quote-unquote legitimate candidates and use polling numbers to decide who can debate and who can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my feeling is that we have a process in place that enables people to make choices. And to the greatest extent that we can, we should leave those choices up to the people. Now, you know, most newspapers cannot afford to cover whatever we're going to have the total, you know, whatever it's going to end up being. We can't afford to cover 15 candidates with the same amount of coverage. We have neither the space in newspapers nor the resources, and it's even more true in broadcast on both counts. But I think we do have a public responsibility not to discount people. And, you know, it's not an easy line to draw. I mean, you may have watched the debate last week, and you saw
sure.
Mike Gravel from Alaska up there ranting and raving and stomping around. And
right,
he hasn't
right.
been in elective office since the 1970s, and it would be disingenuous to suggest that Mike Gravel has the same chance that Barack Obama does and therefore should be given the same amount of coverage. We are gatekeepers. We have decisions to make. But I think we cross that line when we begin to say, and especially people in my business who go on cable TV, and say things like, you know, well, you look at John Edwards and he's raised $10 million less than Obama and Clinton, and how can a guy like that, you know, can he really compete if one of them doesn't self-destruct? You know, that kind of stuff to me is really not helpful.
Right. What's the story with political advertising on television? How much money do the candidates spend during the primary season and for the general election on those kinds of ads? And wouldn't it behoove broadcasters, and I wonder if anybody has suggested this, to lower their rates a little bit? So obviously they're making a ton of money from having all these candidates and raising all this money. But shouldn't we look at that? Isn't it sort of a public service to take these on in a responsible fashion, to air them responsibly so you don't have just the one person who has all the money having all the access to the airwaves?
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, it's more than half of your campaign budget. In some cases, it's, you know, 75%.
Is it really?
Of any given, you know, in different campaigns. And in a, I don't know what the percentage will be for these primaries or presidentials, but certainly that's what's driving the cost. I mentioned earlier how all the front-loaded primaries are driving the cost of campaign. What that is all in broadcast advertising. And not only are they not charging less for those ads, not only are they not, you know, giving them away, they're actually charging more. They actually spike the prices. It's a good old-fashioned price gouging from the broadcasters. But you know what, Kathleen, I would like to see that. I don't know. There's free speech issues. And, you know, I personally think, you know, we as the people give them the licenses and they ought to be serving democracy, but putting the idealism aside, I think they're getting their comeuppance because, as I write in the magazine, I think broadcast is quickly becoming less relevant.
Right.
And, you know, this infuriates the ad guys. I've gotten a lot of emails since I wrote this.
Have you?
From friends of mine who make ads saying, you don't understand what's going on, and this is crazy, and broadcast is here forever, and, you know, this is the only way to reach people. But I just don't think so. I think that defies what we know about technology, and so I think broadcast ads are going to be critical in this cycle, but they're less effective. And as they get less effective, they're going to be seen as less critical. And as the internet sort of supplants traditional broadcast in homes and even traditional cable to some extent, I think you will see just less utility to the money. And it can only then be a matter of time before the money mm-hmm. takes less value than other things.
Mm. You cannot underestimate the importance of TiVo these days, right? I mean, it's a whole new TV viewing experience for me. Goodbye commercials.
And for me, I mean, if I watch a commercial now, it's because I really want to see it, right?
Right.
I never, you know, baseball is the only thing that forces me to watch commercials, and even then, I'm usually, you know, turning down the sound in between, because I no longer, once you get out of the habit, right?
Right.
Of watching commercials,
I know.
Why bother? But you're kind of affronted by them. Now, here's what they'll tell you. Now, you and I will say this, and here's, you know, anybody who makes ads out there who hears this will call you and say, well, Kathleen, you're being classist because you have a TiVo and Matt Bai has a TiVo and so do a lot of other people. You know, probably in Milwaukee there's a bunch of people with TiVos, but in large parts of Wisconsin and large parts of the country, nobody's even heard of this thing. And people who have two parents working and families working shifts, coming home late, they don't have either the time or the inclination to record their programs. It's too expensive. They don't have broadband internet. They watch broadcast TV, and so they're seeing the same ads they always saw, and you're just living in a very rarefied world. But that, to me, is just, that's a classic head in the sand, not looking at the arc of technology attitude. And I hear this, it's argued very vociferously here in Washington, but the fact is technology, the money is to be made in technology, put it this way, when you can bring it to the masses. And that is what happens with every electronic technology, every communications technology, right? I mean, cable TV was a rarefied thing, and now everyone has it. Flat-screen TVs were rarefied, and now everyone has it. TiVo, by best estimates, is going to be in something like 35% of the homes in the next couple of years. It would be pretty silly to think that it's just going to stop there right. and remain a wealthy person's gadget. I mean, you're going to see, you know, 10 years from now, you're going to walk into any housing project in America, and you're going to have digital video recorders.
Right.
And I think that's that there will be other models for forcing people to watch ads or making money, but I think there still will be advertising and political campaigns. I just can't imagine it's going to drive the cost of a campaign the way it does now.
Yeah. Well, you know, all they have to do is sell this TiVo thing. It's going to give you so much more time in your life. We have so many commercials. You can just wipe out. If you're watching the news, you wipe out almost half the news time.
Yeah, I don't really understand that part of the argument either, to be honest with you. Even if, I mean, I just take it on its merits, which is, you know, I just argue the point I just argued, which is that technology is going to make all that irrelevant. But even then, I don't understand the argument that people who have a hard time making ends meet and work so hard for a living don't have the time or the inclination to record programs. I would think that they
right.
have more inclination,
right.
actually,
right. Right.
to record programs.
Makes your life
it may be
easier.
Expensive for them, but it'll get a whole lot less expensive. And I'm like you. I was an early adapter to TiVo. I had the box. Now I have it in my satellite system, and you know, I can't really imagine watching. Not only can I not imagine watching TV without it, I don't know what you have. I can't imagine watching TV without the dual tuner, so that I can record two things at once. Right. So this is like, I mean,
oh,
this
I don't
stuff
know
is
about
changing
that.
Rapidly.
You're ahead of me on that one, Matt.
Oh well, you got to do that because then you can watch one show and record another.
Oh
you know, that's,
no. Okay.
That's the classic. That'll keep you wrapped up in TV for the rest of your life.
Matt Pye is our guest. Let's welcome phone calls for him. He has a piece in the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And perhaps you've seen it. I hope you have. It's the Way We Live Now section. And it's titled The Post-Money Era, Why $50 Million in Campaign Contributions Isn't What It Used to Be. Matt's a contributing writer for the magazine. His book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics will be published in August. And we're welcoming phone calls. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Milwaukee 227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Leah from Green Bay. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, Matt and I don't have anything in common because I refuse to watch TV. But
Oh, my goodness.
You're missing so much, Leah.
I live on Wisconsin Public Radio. But
all right.
Actually, I have two quick comments. One is the airwaves belong to the public, and we license these stations to be able to use them. And I don't understand why we can't put a law in there saying that they can't charge for campaign announcements, and they have to allow free announcements for a certain proportion of the candidates or people. Or so that's one thing. That's something I've been thinking about a lot. And number two, there's a fantastic blog called The Anonymous Liberal, and he or she came up with an idea that I've been thinking about a lot, which is that you would have an ethics board in each state, or maybe nationally, and they would vet all the special interest ads for truth, and that then people could choose to put, you know, the stations could choose to put these ads out, but then at the bottom it would say this has been vetted. In other words, that the content is factual, and maybe that would have prevented some of those ads, you know, against Kerry and some of the other things in the past. And I think that's such a great idea.
Man.
So I'll just hang up and I'll let you talk about it.
Thanks, Leah. Thanks for the call.
I like that idea, Leah. I think that's I think those are pretty good ideas. I mean, I don't know how practical it is to get, even with, I agree with you about the licenses, I don't know how practical it is to get sort of free amounts of political advertising. There's so many candidates would be able to advertise, and it would so subsidize the system that maybe there's some middle ground to be had. And in terms of vetting for truth, that sounds like a pretty good idea to me. I don't know. And maybe we should, I mean, maybe it shouldn't stop at politics. I'd love for them to vet, you know, telephone service ads and cell phone, you know, cell phone providers too. But we've gotten pretty good in recent years, both in the media, and there's some websites, the news media and some websites, there have been some pretty good efforts to vet some of these ads after they're broadcasted. But there's always fights now every cycle about, trying to get networks not to broadcast certain ads that are deemed to be particularly egregious and inaccurate. And I wouldn't think it would be a bad thing to have somebody vet them beforehand if that vetting group could be seen as a credible, non-ideological source.
Let's talk a little bit, because you spend quite a bit of time in the article, and this certainly will be the wave of the future. This ad that this guy created, it was an Obama supporter, you know, the Big Brother Hillary Clinton ad, that the mainstream media picked up, and cable particularly, and then played it over and over and over again. I have a couple questions. One is, how do you even find these kinds of ads on the internet, and how do they find their way to mainstream media, and how will they figure in this campaign and future campaigns in terms of their importance?
Well, a couple of things. It's interesting. I was at Stanford University a couple of weeks ago and did a panel there, which I would say got about 75 people there, most of them from the community. I mean, it was sort of a baby boomer or older crowd. And I asked the audience how many people had seen this ad, and more than half the people there.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it was really extraordinary.
Yeah.
And you know, the question of how it gets out there is a good one. I think this is an incredibly viral process. I'm not sure anyone knows. I think that's an excellent question. I'm not sure anyone knows the answer exactly. I can tell you personally, I saw my editor sent it to me. He'd gotten it from someone else. You know, once it's up on YouTube, I think a lot of this is very, very viral and just goes all over the place. And I also understand that the guy who made that ad is actually about to get hired by a major consulting firm that does ads in Washington. So here we go, right? It's a classic rags-to-riches story.
Right.
I don't know how much he was in rags. But, you know, I think this is, you know, this changes the dynamic tremendously because there's a trust issue here, right? And that one of the reasons people tune out broadcast ads, and we know they do, and not just for politics, and this has been commented on a lot, it's just the basic trend in society toward deconstructing marketing and toward trying not to be manipulated. You know, I have a little boy, and my little boy was wearing a T-shirt the other day that said Reebok on it, and one of my neighbors actually commented, you know, why is he wearing advertising? And
right.
This is a big thing now among kids, you know, with kids' clothing. Is, you know, none of us want to be sort of willing pawns in this marketing culture. And so people tune out advertising, but somehow when it's on the internet, it's done by a citizen and it's put together for free, it has this air of authenticity, and it somehow becomes a piece of art or a piece of persuasion instead of another paid tool. And so I think that makes it a very powerful format. You know, ironically, it'll be interesting to see whether the standard traditional political ads, when they move online, will have any more value than they do on TV. I suspect that a lot of this is cultural and that it doesn't really matter where you see them. It's more about who made them and why.
Mm-hmm. Back to phone calls. Bruce is next from Eau Claire. Hi, Bruce.
Hi there. One of the things that bothers me most, I think, about broadcast ads and political ads in particular is the frequency with which we see them. The number of times that they'll be on in a given program.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you've done anything with the concept of saturation advertising, if there's any kind of definition of how many spots in a given hour qualifies as saturation advertising. We've got a proposal here in Wisconsin to extend the sales tax to areas that haven't been taxed previously, and I was thinking that possibly if they extended the sales tax to saturation broadcast advertising, that might raise some money.
You know, it's a good question. I know you all in Wisconsin get it badly, and I mean, it's true before the primary. And I mean, when you go out to, or before the general, but when you go out to like a state like Ohio or Florida or some of these states where a lot of broadcast markets and huge importance in the primaries and then in the general, it's, you know, I only stay there for a week, and I don't know how you all take it. You know, I just want to run screaming because we don't really get that in Washington, certainly, or in New York, but it's incredibly annoying the amount of saturation you get. I don't know that there's been any work done on that. It's an interesting proposal. I think what will regulate, as I was saying before, I think what's going to regulate that to some extent is going to be the market itself. That I think it's going to. There's been a supposition that when advertising isn't working as much as you'd like it to, you need to spend more on it and saturate it. I liken this to the idea of saying, you know, Grandpa, you don't like my rap music? Hang on, I'm turning up the volume, right? It's like, how about now? Do you like it now, right? So the political philosophy, I think, driven by consultants who get paid, by the way, by the size of the ad buy, is that if you keep buying more ads, somehow the message will seep through. I suspect that that's going to become a less credible way to look at advertising. I can't imagine why cycle after cycle, people are going to want to spend the money it takes to saturate the airwaves in the way that you're describing,
mm-hmm.
With ads that are just clearly not having the intended mm-hmm. impact, when there are other media, either, if not, you know, cable television, the internet, whatever, when there are other media, niche media, where you can get your message out cheaper and with greater impact.
Thanks very much for the call. You want to talk more about that niche media? What is it?
Yeah, well, I mean, this is the trend everywhere, right? It's in marketing and it's in media. It's that there's just so many outlets now that people are very specialized. You know, we all have our thing, right? I read about the Yankees all day long. I got about three websites.
The Yankees? You got the wrong team, man. It's the Brewers this year.
I believe it, actually, but I was born to it, so it's too late to switch.
All right.
I go to baseball websites. There's people who advertise, obviously, are trying to reach people on those sites because it's a very specific kind of consumer. And depending on what the niche is, you can tell more, you know, a lot more about your consumer. You all in public broadcasting certainly have a niche for sort of affluent intellectual viewership or listenership, and that and advertisers are aware of this. So political campaigns are aware of this too, and increasingly they can target to an audience either on cable or through mailings. Or I suspect that's going to migrate onto the internet in a very big way, and so the era of sort of blanketing, you know, what broadcast ads is a carpet bombing, right? It's, you know, we're going to put it all over ABC and NBC in New Hampshire or in Iowa or wherever, and you know, it's going to just hit. Everybody has to come across these channels some way, somehow, if they watch any TV, and that was the old model because there weren't all these other outlets, and I think we're going to get away from carpet bombing and more to stay with the egregious military metaphor, more toward sort of these laser-guided missiles where I think, you know, campaigns, particularly Republican campaigns and now Democrats, are just starting to catch up. They're getting smart to the idea that there are more effective, cost-efficient ways to reach the people you need to reach on a given
right.
issue.
Yeah. We go to Elaine from Appleton. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I've just got a few comments. Everything he said is true because I worked in politics for 38 years. Our paper, newspaper ads, depending on the day of the week, a third, a fourth, or a half can be devoted to sports, nothing to political news. And on our licensing of these stations, they have been surveys made, and they're supposed to be serving the public with, news. 99.4 of the stations, and they've been monitored, never have any political news on. It's a 0.06 that is political news, and most of it is usually scandals. And raising these large funds to get your message across is needed, badly needed. And most of the time, the newspapers don't even cover anybody unless they feel it would sell newspapers. And there, and I'm extremely angry that the Wisconsin and Manufacturing and Commerce elected our last judge to the Supreme Court here in Wisconsin. I don't think these people should get a license unless they start serving the public with political news. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Matt.
Yeah, I appreciate Elaine saying I'm right. I don't hear that very often. And and what she says makes sense to me. I just don't know what you do about it. I tend to agree. And I know Ralph Nader, I know that's a dirty word for a lot of Democrats, but dirty two words, but Ralph Nader used to make this point all the time. You know, we own the airways, and we ought to be telling them what public service amounts to. And
mm-hmm.
I think it makes a lot of sense. I just, you know, I live in Washington, and in the realism of it is that I don't see a great movement to do this, and there's a tremendous amount of money invested. There's a tremendous amount of power among the people who own these licenses, and I don't see any time soon there being these, you know, much tougher restrictions and rules placed on them. But, you know, we do it for educational TV, right? You have to do a certain amount of educational television. Yes, they fudge on the definition of it, but, you know, you do get your educational programming and your news programming. That's a large part of why we still have news programming, is because they have to do it. And I don't really see why the same can't be true of campaign coverage, of the airtime for campaigns. I mean, I there have been debates, and this issue came up a couple of years ago where I want to say, go ahead, I don't want to get this wrong because I'll just start a firestorm, but I think I'm pretty certain it was ABC who bid and won a debate among candidates in the primaries, and then their affiliates didn't carry the debate because their affiliates just wanted their programming and didn't really want to be.
Right, I remember that. Remember yes, that? Yes.
That to me was the most egregious example.
Yes.
That really, you know, I was saying the same thing at the time, which is, you know, enough. Like, that crosses a line. You do have a public responsibility. And if you're not, if you're going to refuse to carry the public, you know, the public's business that you've bid for because, you know, you want to make money, then it's time for somebody to step in and tell you, remind you of your responsibilities. I think that's true.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Frank from Madison next. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
I'm fine.
Good.
Happy May Day.
Happy May Day to you,
and
Frank.
And to your guest. I have a question, and perhaps the guest already knows that this is happening. But at what point can we anticipate political advertising to sort of join the culture of contempt, to embrace a self-irony? You see this with advertisements from corporations like the Bank of Scotland and the IBM, where they have subversive ads that send up the system, and yet that's a way of promoting yourself. And is that what happens when politicians expose themselves to Jon Stewart?
What a good question.
Yeah, it's great.
Frank, that's a good question. You know, a buddy of mine by the name of Bill Hilsman, who you may or may not have heard of in Wisconsin, I suspect a lot of people have, but he's an ad guy out of Minneapolis, and he did the ads for Paul Wellstone when he ran in 1989, and again, was it 1989, 1990? Somewhere around there. And for Jesse Ventura when he ran for governor initially in 1998. And Hilsman has long sort of adopted this stance in political advertising. You know, Hilsman will tell you the problem with political ads isn't that no one pays attention. The problem is that they're terrible and that they're all the same everywhere.
Right,
you know, there's, you know, and they all start out with, you know, Bob Jones says he's this or that, but, you know, can we really trust him? And there's a dark, shadowy, grainy image and a split screen, and
yeah,
there's all the
it.
Things that are wrong with him. And, you know, people have tuned this stuff out. They've seen it a million times. The consultants keep making the same ad over and over again. Meanwhile, you see an ad like Geico's Cavemen, right, which has broken through to the extent that they're going to have a sitcom.
No kidding.
Yeah, because people, there's a piece about this in the magazine, my colleague Rob Walker a couple weeks ago. Because people, you know, really find it funny and amusing, and it sort of, you know, it's very intelligent advertising. And Hilsman has had a lot of success doing this. His last client was Ned Lamont, actually, in Connecticut, where they had less success, but did win the primary. So, you know, why this hasn't happened already, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. The Washington political consultants are very conservative and keep doing the same thing they're doing, and frankly, I think it's largely because they all take on a dozen or more clients a cycle. And it's difficult. They're spread thin, and they don't want to spend a lot of money on production values or on the production of the ads because that's bad for the candidate. And so they have a tendency to make the same ad over and over and over again. And I wonder, like Frank does, if the you know, sort of the advent of the internet and the increasing role that the internet's going to play in these campaigns won't improve the quality of ads, because you can't get away with that on the internet. I mean, if you want to make something viral, if you want people emailing it to each other, it has to be as creative as that ad we were talking about before with Hillary Clinton as Big Brother.
Interesting.
Which was pretty creative.
Yeah. Anything else, Frank? Frank's gone. Thanks, Frank, very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have a few more minutes with Matt Bai, and then we will be talking with Roger Simon, who's the CEO and co-founder of Pajamas Media. They do analysis and commentary of issues of the day, a lot of political they have a politics center as part of what they're doing. So we'll talk in a moment with Roger. Our number, 800-486-8655. Amelia from Oregon. Hi.
Yeah, this call stems from your comments of a few callers ago where you were describing all of the technology and quoting the percentages of people who will have it in 10 years. And I feel like somewhat of an anachronism because of where I live, which is out in the country. And by virtue of who of my providers are, I still have dial-up with no opportunity in the near or distant future of upgrading to DSL. I have, regular television, the five channels, with no opportunity of upgrading. I have, you know, cable isn't an option, and satellite's too expensive. So I have what are considered the old-fashioned media outlets, regular rabbit-ear television, dial-up internet, which is excruciatingly slow. So I still get my information the slow way. So I'm wondering, you know, so I very rarely sit down and watch TV. If I want to watch a series television program, I order it with via Netflix.
Oh, my. She's living in another world, huh? Matt?
Well, it's not, I mean, it's not that rare what you're describing, Amelia. I mean, you see, any, you know, in lots of places. I was at, actually at a blogger's house, one of the main bloggers in Daily Coast, who lives in the hills above Santa Barbara, which is a pretty, you know, major area in Southern California. And, you know, they couldn't get cable TV up there in the hills or satellite or whatever it was. I mean, they were, you know, they had just gotten broadband within the last couple of years. And so we still have a large part of the country, not a tiny part, that actually isn't taking part in this information revolution. And it's not always an income situation. It's often just a issue of remoteness and technology. We've had a real failing of government, frankly, I think, in taking the lead on this. And this is a classic infrastructure issue. If there's anything that people should be able to agree on government doing, right, like building the highways, you would think that building broadband coverage, satellite coverage and all of that would be part of it. But it's coming. I mean, you know, it's coming some places faster than others, and maybe I'm Pollyannish, and maybe we'll be having the same conversation in 10 years because there's been no government initiative and no profit motive for companies to go build the very expensive networking that's required to bring that to that part of Oregon or that part of Santa Barbara. But I do think if you just look at, anecdotally, just look at the penetration difference between now and 5 or 6 years ago, right? I mean, a couple of years ago, even here in my neighborhood in Washington, you couldn't get, the DSL wasn't ready yet, you know. You had, you know, you could get a cable modem maybe 5 years ago. You couldn't get DSL even a couple of years ago. Now you can get all kinds of stuff. I just think it's taken a little time, and it would take less time with a little better planning, a sort of national planning on this. But I do think we're in right now in this transitional period, which is why a lot of people can't see it happening and sort of think all the hype is overblown. It's going to take a lot longer to become an internet society where your entertainment is provided sort of through online channels than it did, say, to go from radio to TV, which only took a couple years. But I definitely think it's coming.
Yeah, Matt, thanks so much for being with us. Thanks for the article. Please join us again.
Well, thanks. I appreciate it, and I appreciate you mentioning the book as well. I do think for people who care about democratic politics and sort of how technology and ordinary people are changing the landscape of democratic politics. Hopefully it'll be interesting.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll line you up for an interview.
I'd appreciate it. Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Thanks, Matt. Matt Bai, and you can read his article about how the internet is changing political campaign advertising, the role of money. It's in today's Tuesday, Sunday's New York Times Magazine section, The Way We Live, that part of the magazine. We're going to pause for just a moment. We'll return and talk more about the importance of the internet in getting political news as well. We're going to be speaking with the CEO and the co-founder of PajamasMedia.com. They cover elections, world, and political issues. And the director says our Politics Central initiative was actually motivated by some surprising research findings about American voters. So we'll talk with him about that and their straw poll and their political analysis of what's happening in Washington. And it's a pretty neat website. So we'll be with him in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we do want to remind you that the pledge drive starts this Thursday. We've already, this is good news, been able to raise $19,000 from you generous contributors who have pledged online. You can do that right now if you'd like and help us shorten this drive. Just go to WPR.org. Joining us now is Roger Simon, and Roger is the CEO and co-founder of PajamasMedia.com, which is a very interesting website. They have coverage and analysis and commentary of issues of the day. They have a network of over 90 worldwide bloggers and have original stories, podcasts, and videos. And it's worth checking out. It's a good one. PajamasMedia.com. They cover elections, world, and political issues. And our guest, the CEO, Roger Simon, says their Politics Central initiatives was motivated by some surprising research findings about American voters. We'll ask him what that is. We'll look at all that they're doing politically and the importance of the internet in this presidential kind of endless campaign. Hello, Roger.
Well, nice to be here.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, I love you. I love this site.
Well, thank you.
But the darn thing is, how do you find out about all of this? I go to the web all the time. I'm reading newspapers. But how do you find out? Now we know more because I'm interviewing you, and I'll go to your site all the time. But how do people find these?
Well, we have several full-time editors working for us. I mean, we're one of the first ones, probably with the Huffington Post, to be, an actual online kind of news and opinion site with bloggers taking the forefront.
Right. Yeah, it's very good. You have said that your Politics Central initiative was motivated by some surprising research findings about American voters. What are those?
Well, I think it comes down to this. The people who self-identify as neither liberal or conservative is bigger than those who self-identify as either one of the two poles.
Hmm.
People don't want to be pinned down that way.
Mm-hmm.
More voters in this survey that we did with the hoity-toity Princeton research, so it was done according to Hoyle, I should say, came out with the startling finding that, and I find it sort of startling because I'm that way and a lot of people are that way. My opinions rage all over the lot. They don't want to be in a box, and the American public doesn't want to be in a box.
Mm-hmm.
Which traditionally augurs well for the center in a presidential election, but I think it's a more interesting phenomenon than that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it relates to the media likes to put everybody in a left-right box because it sort of makes politics to be like sports.
Right.
You're a Laker fan, you're a Knicks fan, whatever. But it's not that. The world is still more complicated than that. I think people are smart enough to realize it.
Yeah. But don't you think politics is a little like sports?
Oh, well, yes.
Yeah.
It's run, because it's run like sports, and the media is a money-making institution.
Right, right.
I mean, so we have our fans. Some are for Obama, and some are for Giuliani, and yada, yada. And money is to be made by this.
Right, yeah. So tell me how those of us who are going to vote, who are really involved in politics, I'm still trying to get a handle on how the Internet is going to shape what we think, how people are going through the Internet to find videos that are there or ads that are there or commentaries that are there. How is it playing a huge role in this campaign, Roger?
Well, first of all, self-promotion, go to pajamasmedia.com and vote in our presidential straw poll.
Yeah, you should. I mean, it's a great website. People should do that right now.
But,
I agree.
In the larger thing beyond us, I think what you'll find about the Internet is it's going to have a salutary effect on politics. I mean, like everything, it's not all pluses and minuses. A lot of people on the Internet, as everybody knows, are pretty extreme. But what it will do is it opens up for the average citizen a place for discourse on all these things. So there are a lot of good spin-offs, one of which I believe you were talking about the political advertising not being quite as important as it was.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we have Pajamas Media Welcome and are financed in part by political advertising, but it's web advertising, which is cheaper. But in a larger sense, if you can track the rise of certain candidates which are coming off the web now rather than in other conventional means. And I think we'll grow even more. Like, for example, we all know about the rise of the Howard Dean campaign, in the last presidential election. This time, I think one to watch on the web is actually Fred Thompson.
Really?
He's doing very well on the – he's winning on the Republican side on the pajamas poll right now. And what we think about our poll is, because it's an open Internet poll, it's a sort of a harbinger of things to come.
Huh.
And Thompson has not declared as a candidate, yet is scoring above, on almost all the national polls, above Mitt Romney, who is has more money than any other candidate on the Republican side.
Yeah,
so something's going on here.
Hmm.
Now, how that is happening is not entirely Internet-driven. I mean, first of all, to figure that out would be, I don't think anybody could. I mean, it would take, a country of statisticians. But on the other hand, it's an interesting phenomenon.
Hmm.
Just as with the rise of Dean out of nowhere with very little money being spent, comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
Again, comparatively, and in this case, no money has been spent on Thompson, yet I would say if you had to ask me who will be the Republican nominee, I would say right now, and this is really not fair because it's a wild guess, it's going to be between Giuliani and Thompson.
No kidding.
That's just me.
Huh.
I mean, I maybe as I'm supposed to be impartial CEO. Indeed, I am. I'm just giving you my horse race.
Yeah, interesting.
My horse race view.
Huh.
And you know, on the Democratic side, of course, we all know that Barama has had a remarkable rise.
Right.
Now, part of that is generated on the net. There's no question about it. I mean, he his fundraising numbers are quite high, and they're, you know, almost equal or equal to Clinton's.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we can't say that it's entirely the net. But they have not begun to spend that money that much.
Hmm.
So where does this rise of Barama come from? Well, he's a charismatic guy, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also coming from the net.
From
the net is pushing Thompson, is pushing Barama, it's pushing new figures. This probably is good for democracy in the long run, because it shows, you know, that the grassroots can affect things.
Yeah, right.
Because effectively, Hillary Clinton, whether you like her or not, was a figure that was being essentially a coronation for the Democratic nomination.
Sure.
A year ago.
Sure. So on the Democratic side, you want to go out on a limb there?
Well, I mean, I'm not because you know, the Democratic side is quite evident. If you look at the latest Rasmussen poll, shows Clinton and Barama, shows Barama up by a point or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is startling for a guy that a lot of people hadn't heard of a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does this phenomenon march that fast? The internet obviously has a huge influence.
Right. So you're doing these day after debates sessions, right, on your website?
We have the Corn and Miniter show, which is our weekly video show with David Corn on the left and Richard Miniter on the right. And David is the editor of the Washington Editor of the Nation, and Rich is our Washington editor. And they go at it weekly about what's taking the temperature of the pajamas poll, debates, everything. What's happened that week? And people can see that online, pops up Friday morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they do it in a kind of more, we deliberately said, let's not be Hannity and Combs. These guys don't scream at each other. they make fun of each other, kind of, you know. There's
right.
There's banter, but there's not, you know, we're trying, this is, let's say, this is Hannity Combs for NPR listeners.
Uh-huh. Okay, I like that. We'll tune into that. Why are you doing this?
Excuse me?
Why are you doing this?
Why are we doing the,
yeah,
putting
why
that
did you,
on?
Why? No, why did you start the website? What's?
Oh, why did we impose
yeah.
Thomas Media and Jen?
Well,
right. It's a very American story in its way, because a lot of us had started blogging. I have been, and I am a novelist and a screenwriter. A lot of us started blogging to entertain ourselves, or in my case, to promote a novel I had coming out. And, you know, but other people had other reasons. All of a sudden, certain numbers of these blogs got very popular. And more people were reading my blog than reading my novels, I blush to say. Now, of course, the blog was free. So, so I and a few others, Glenn Reynolds, the Instapundit, and Charles Johnson of Little Green, we banded together and we said, well, how can we turn, you know, if we have 20,000, 50,000 people reading our site every day or more, how do we turn this into some money? And also, how do we turn it into something that has more impact for the future?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, both of those things were late in some ways. I mean, this is a capitalist society.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how Pajamas Media formed. I mean, we ran around looking for investment to get it done. We got some investment, and here we are.
Great. That's terrific. So how will you take us through this very, very long presidential year? What are you offering us?
Well, we're offering you several things. The weekly poll, which we encourage everybody to vote in, because it's fun.
Yeah.
And we do it every – you can vote once a week because it's our contention that people should be changing their mind at
all
this
right.
Point.
I like this idea.
Yeah, because, you know, frankly speaking, I don't know who I'm going to vote for in November of 2008. That's a long time off. I may find out a lot of things about different people.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, so we'll be tracking that poll. We'll be running the Corn and Miniter show, where they'll be discussing it every week.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have a forum on there you can click on, and you can join in the discussion on this.
Hmm.
Then also we're going to have further events as we get closer to the primaries themselves. We'll sponsor our own debates and that will have to do with the candidates, also to bloggers involved, also to people in the campaigns and all the rest of it.
All right. Roger, thank you. Join us again, all right? I'm glad we
delighted.
Yeah, we linked up the first time. We'll talk to you during this long campaign season. Roger Simon, CEO and co-founder of Pajamas Media. And you can look at their website and, you know, why not vote once a week? This is good. Change your mind, keep voting for president. It's www.pajamas, like, you know, what you wear at night, pajamasmedia.com. Thanks to Carmen Jackson for producing this hour. We thank Matt Bai for being with us as well from the New York Times, looking at politics this second hour of our program today. And thanks to John Treader for doing all the on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios this Tuesday, the 1st of May. If you'd like a copy of this hour, call the radio store. Their phone number is 800-747-7444, and the program number of this hour is 51E. This show will also repeat tonight at 10 o'clock, in case you wanted to tell somebody about it. We'll be with you again tomorrow from 9 to 11, talking about important current issues and we'll hope you'll be a part of the discussion. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.